In November 1990, the body of a 17-year-old First Nations boy was found on the outskirts of Saskatoon City, Canada. It wouldn't be until a decade later that the truth behind the teenager's death would be officially acknowledged, exposing systematic racism within the city's police department and its lethal practice of the Starlight Tour. This is what happens when those tasked with your protection do not value your life. This is the killing of Neil Stonechild. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is infuriating. It's infuriating. And I've covered it because sometimes we like to lie in our beds just feeling secure about the authorities. We like to believe that at the end of the day, if things go wrong, we're going to be safe. And for the most part, lots of us can genuinely enjoy that luxury. But it doesn't translate everywhere, and it certainly doesn't translate to certain communities. And the case of Neil Stonechild certainly makes me feel that way. It makes me question so many things and makes me want to bring this story to you, because Neil Stonechild had great meaning, and he was denied further meaning in this world because of the authorities. So strap in. You're not going to feel happy when I tell you this tale. Also, before I start today's case, thank you so much for joining me as ever, and thank you for supporting me. Thank you for giving me Patreon subs and YouTube membership. It means I can do all of this. I adore you. But as well, if you've just arrived here and you watch this content, then please subscribe. You'll be very much appreciated. So let's start with today's case, and also let's just look at some history first of all. Sounds like I'm about to do a lesson. Just stay with me on this. It's important that we kind of understand what we're talking about today. So for thousands of years, Canada province of Saskatchewan has been inhabited by various Aboriginal Indigenous groups. Now, these are the original peoples of North America and their descendants. This is including the Indigenous Indians or First Nations, as they are now more commonly known. Now, there are more than 630 First Nation communities in Canada. However, following the arrival of European settlers in the 18th century, more and more Indigenous people lost their land and also simultaneously lost their rights. They were basically robbed of all their rights and their land under the terms of these various treaties that were entered into with the Crown. Now, since these times, First Nations people have literally been, and it's very well documented, subjected to systematic racism and generations of oppression. And all of this has absolutely historically and presently affected things like socioeconomic status of Indigenous people and also opportunities of Indigenous people. And then add to that the way that general society treats certain individuals who, bear in mind, are the original inhabitants of the country and land, and yet for some reason have been considered less than those who came after them. Now, like lots, in fact many, I would say, other Indigenous populations across the world, they have genuinely paid this enormous price due to colonization. And I think that it's something that in our present history, we don't necessarily think about it a great deal, but imagine your whole world, culture, land, your ownership of the world that you come from being taken from you, and then not just being taken from you, placing oppressive systems upon you so that you don't even get to enjoy a life that you deserve. And as I said, it's hard when you're in this modern day and age to imagine that that's happened and that still happens in places, and it's a very depressing fact. And another depressing fact is that in many countries, if not all countries, certainly the UK and the US included, the insidious nature of racism finds its way into positions of power, and particularly in positions of power like the police. We in the UK have had enormous investigations into institutional racism in the police, and the situation is absolutely no different in Canada, something you are going to really connect with when I tell you this story today. Now, Aboriginals have complained of unfair treatment and police brutality for decades. This is not something that is rare. It is well documented. It is well recognised. However, changes have not been made because it's just fallen on deaf ears. This is people from communities expressing that they are consistently, regularly dealing with police brutality from a position of racist officers, and in spite of their complaints, nothing is changing. Now, like so many minorities across the globe, they have basically been persecuted on account of their race. And this has led to them actually losing their lives on account of their race. So let me take you back to Thursday, the 25th of November, 1990, Saskatoon, Canada. It's around noon, and the press start to report that a frozen body of this unidentified male has been found by workers face down in a field. This is in the city's undeveloped north industrial area. Now, at the moment that they discover the body and it gets out, the belief is they're dealing with a male between around 30 and 35 years of age. Apparently, there was no obvious cause of death. Just remember that for later. No obvious. Sorry, Emma, is it obvious? No. There's nothing obvious to say how this person died. Are you sure there was nothing obvious? Absolutely nothing. Nothing to see here. Just hold on to that. So members of the police's identification section, they join the police tracking dogs at the scene, and they're trying to figure out who this poor person is, who's dead and face down in this field, but they can't find any ID, and they also can't establish what killed him. Sorry for the sarcasm this early on. Please understand there is a reasoning behind it. Now, it's soon established that this apparent 30 to 35-year-old male isn't 30 to 35 at all. In fact, he was 17-year-old Neil Christopher Stonechild. We're talking about a kid. I have a son that age. He's a child. Sometimes we forget how young 17 is. We reflect on our own childhoods, our own teenagehoods, and we always imagine ourselves with the same mindset that we have as an adult. We can look at some of the silly mistakes that we made and put that down to childish intent and experience. But for the most part, we kind of feel that we're the same, but we're not. He was 17, a 17-year-old kid. And when they do the autopsy, this is what it concludes, apparently, that he died of hypothermia during the early hours of the day that he was found. Now, that isn't surprising, of course, because if you're left in freezing temperatures, bear in mind that night there'd been a snowstorm. It had dropped to minus 28 degrees C. Can you imagine that? It is harrowing. I mean, when we talk about freezing to death, that is the most incomprehensible torture. What happens to you when you get hypothermia is there's mass disorientation, hallucinations, all of these terrible things go on. Sometimes people, when they're incredibly cold and they're losing it because the confusion is occurring, because the blood is trying to be kept around the brain to keep you alive, etc., people even take their clothes off. That's the oddness that occurs with hypothermia. So when you find climbers dead, sometimes they'll have removed items of clothing because everything is just losing the reality of what the body requires. Now, when they find this young man and recognize that obviously getting so cold has been a big contributor to his death, what's really weird is that Neil had literally been wearing just jeans and a light jacket. That's completely inadequate clothing for that condition. And if you live anywhere in that vicinity, you're going to know that that's a completely inadequate thing to wear. Why would you only be wearing a light jacket? That says to me that you're going somewhere where you don't expect to get cold, or you're staying somewhere where you shouldn't be cold, or that maybe the jacket that you had was taken from you. So he's also found just wearing one shoe. Even more bizarre is that where Neil's body was actually found, that's 9 kilometres out of town, which is on the outer edges of Saskatoon, there's no reason for him to be there. So how does he get 9 kilometres out of town, somewhere that he shouldn't be, and he's wearing completely inadequate clothing? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It's the middle of a snowstorm. Why on earth would he be there? It makes literally no sense whatsoever. So let's look at Neil for a minute. Well, Neil was a member of Saskatoon's Indigenous First Nation, Saulteaux. this is a population of indigenous individuals. And that French translates of Saulteaux is people of the rapids. So Neil's family had actually moved to Saskatoon from Manitoba, and that was in 1980. They lived in a suburb of bungalows on the west side of town. And he was the second youngest sibling of his family. Let me put it out there. He was a really attractive, popular, well-liked teenager in the community. He had a really, really good personality. And people who knew him said he was one of those individuals that you just wanted to be around. He was just cool and interesting and fun, and people warmed to him. And he indeed must have had a very warm personality for people to want to be around him. He was allegedly always the center of attention, known to be very kind-hearted. He was very much himself. People say that he was an authentic person, and everybody knew who he was because of the fact that he was always that human. He didn't wear a mask. And his friends and his family said he was just really sweet. He was a keen sportsman. He was very active in his local church. So obviously trying to keep his life on track, ideally join pro-social environments and activities that could progress him as a young person. Also worth noting that he was pretty skilled in wrestling. So he wrestled in tournaments through high school. He'd actually already won a provincial bantamweight title. So he was good. And he spent a lot of time training. He actually even tried to teach his friends. I love that. I love it when you've got a friend and they're like, you should totally do this. And you're like, I don't want to do that. And they're like, you should do it because it's amazing. I don't think I'd survive. You should do it anyway. I enjoy it. That kind of person. He was very much trying to entice people to get involved in the interests that he had. So it was obviously something that he really connected with and felt that other people would benefit from. Also worth noting that his family had been important as far as I believe as human beings in Canada, because several members of his extended family had actually been in the Canadian military. So these are pro-social people. And the reality is that it seems that Neil genuinely felt like he was going to follow suit. Also, he was incredibly close to his older brother, Marcel, and they actually joined the cadets together, which obviously would have been a great foundation for him joining the military later. And they both loved being in the cadets. Things had changed a little bit for him during his teenage years. I mean, for the vast majority of us out there, teenage years, shall I say, make us consider alternative exercises and activities to what we may have been doing in our early youth and childhood. You know, he started drinking with his mates, and even though that wasn't excessive, so he would hang out with them, he would have alcohol, it wasn't problematic. And it had obviously started to bother him, it had obviously started to concern him that he wasn't doing the best with his life, and he'd actually even spoken to his mum and said that he wanted to find some new friends who didn't get into trouble. He could see that he was going down that path, and that he knew that he really needed to make a decision to take a different direction. It does seem that some of those friends that he was hanging out with and drinking with, they got involved in things like petty crime, and that caused him some issues. He got into trouble a couple of times too. So he's apparently serving a 6-month open custody sentence at a group home at the time of his death. So this is a sentence that basically is served in a group home, not an institution. And he'd actually been in the process during that period of time of addressing those personal issues, focusing on the future. And I would say, according to all of the evidence that I've read and the people who've talked about this young man, he was somebody who literally loved life. He had a real thirst for adventure. He had everything to live for. But every single part and piece of that possible future, of that progressive experience, it all ended during a snowstorm in a frozen field by himself at 17. Now, the circumstances surrounding Neil's death were apparently a mystery. A mystery, apparently. Just a mystery. How does this 17-year-old kid end up in a field, frozen to death, wearing inappropriate clothing? No one knows. Saskatoon police, they conducted their own inquiry. We'll just conduct our own inquiry. Yes, we'll conduct it. This is headed at the time by Sergeant Keith Jarvis of its ironically named Morality Department. I cannot describe at this moment how utterly bizarre Morality Department is when you consider what I'm going to tell you today. This should not be called a Morality Department. Maybe put an I and an M in front of it, and we could be talking at that point. Now, Jarvis, who basically did this moral investigation, he concluded it was an unfortunate accident. So apparently Neil was intoxicated and he'd been walking to jail to turn himself in for being absent from his group home. That's right. Apparently Neil was so committed to turning himself in that he did it in the middle of a snowstorm, in jeans and a light jacket. Just tragically died of exposure in the severe conditions. And one officer at the time stated this: the kid went out, got drunk, went for a walk and froze to death. If that isn't something that happens on a regular weekend, I don't know what's going on in the force. Seriously. Seriously. The kid just went out, got drunk, basically walked and froze to death. Literally. And the police file on this very investigation that we're talking about into Neil's death, well, that would magically and surprisingly be destroyed in 1998 during a routine purge of old files. We've just destroyed it. We've just lost all the evidence that could suggest that maybe this wasn't an appropriate investigation. How inconvenient is that? But the Saskatoon police, well, they seem entirely satisfied with the findings of its inquiry. Oh, we're very satisfied that this inquiry is the correct inquiry and it's been done morally and appropriately. Anyway, the reality is that there were so many unanswered questions, it's unbelievable. You know, Neil's family wanted answers. Their child was dead. They wanted to know, how did Neil manage to find himself alone so far out of town during a snowstorm? Why did he only have one shoe? What were the marks on the bridge of his nose? Yeah, you remember that thing about the nothing to see here? Apparently there were a few things. There were two parallel cuts on the mark of his nose. And during the open casket funeral on the 3rd of December 1990, friends and family had literally looked at his body and gone, what are these? This is strange. Now this would begin the start of a decade-long fight for justice for Neil. So regardless of the police's investigation's finding, Neil's family and literally every other Indigenous man and woman in the city, they knew exactly how Neil had died. They already had the reality of what played out answered in their minds, because Neil wasn't the only person who was found frozen to death in these circumstances. In fact, there was no mystery whatsoever for Neil's family over how he died. Because for over a decade, Aboriginals had complained of police brutality culminating in the unresolved deaths of First Nation men and boys. Deaths which police claimed had been unfortunate accidents caused by excess alcohol and cold weather. How convenient. Now, Neil's mother, Stella Bignall, and older sister, they knew there'd been foul play. Simple as that. But they would have to wait for two strikingly similar incidents, shall we say, 10 years later, before Neil's death would be fully independently investigated. So on the 29th of January 2000, a body of 25-year-old First Nation man Rodney Nastus was found in a field near Queen Elizabeth Power Station. He'd frozen to death. And 3 years earlier, in 1997, the humour section of a local paper, Saskatoon Sun, had actually featured a story by police officer Brian Traynor in which it described two fictional police officers picking up a drunk man and dropping him off on the city outskirts near the Queen Elizabeth Power Station. Is that a coincidence? Is it a coincidence that a guy turns up dead just near the Queen Elizabeth Power Station, who's been dropped off by police whilst drunk and then turned up dead. Obviously, fictionally. Weird. Weird that 3 years later that actually happens. Then we get to the 3rd of February 2000. Bear in mind, this is literally just days after the discovery of Rodney's body, a frozen body of another First Nation man's found in the same location. And this time, the deceased man was 30-year-old Lawrence Wegner. He was found without a jacket in sub-zero conditions. Why wouldn't you have a jacket in sub-zero conditions? And also, these individuals are grown men. They know what the weather's like. They've lived long enough to know how dangerous it would be to be out in very light clothing in the middle of the early hours and be attempting to go anywhere. It does not compute. Now, following those two deaths, Cree Nation member Darryl Knight, well, he reported similar experiences. So in January 2000, he'd actually been drinking at his uncle's house. And as happens sometimes, I don't know, with alcohol and family members, an argument broke out. So Darryl had been shouting, he'd been swearing, and then he gets arrested and he gets taken into custody. That all makes sense. There were two white police officers who actually dealt with the arrest. This is Dan Hatchin and Ken Munson. Now, they placed him in a police car. Darryl, at this point, is obviously not very happy. He's been arrested, but at the end of the day, he's expecting a night in the drunk tank. But that isn't what happens. Darryl isn't taken to the police station. Instead, he'd been driven 3 miles to the outskirts of town on a literally freezing night. They made him get out of the car, and then they left him in exactly the same area as Rodney and Lawrence. But on top of that, the officers removed his coat, and they said, you need to make your own way home. Now, according to Darryl, one of the officers even said to him, get the fuck out of here, you fucking Indian. I have no idea how words like that can come out of somebody who's meant to be protective and in authority to look after individuals. I can't believe that these kind of people get jobs to have that kind of racist intention. How dare he? How dare he? Now, Darryl replied to this, I'll freeze out here. What's wrong with you guys? The officer's response was, that's your effing problem. Darryl had been abandoned by a river in sub-zero temperatures. He was wearing just jeans, a t-shirt, and a denim jacket. Now, thank God he actually survived and he actually managed to walk 2 miles, and then he came to a power station and the watchman in the power station actually helped him. But this could have been a completely different story. We could have been adding his body to the list of these individuals who were found frozen to death. Now, initially, the officers claimed that Darryl had requested to be let out of the police car. Sorry. Tell me that again. Yeah, Darryl was in the police car. We were gonna take him to the drunk tank. And he was like, man, just let me out of the car. And we were like, okay. You were like, okay. We were like, okay, it's fine. So you were meant to arrest him and take him to the police station. Yeah, but then you decided that you wouldn't arrest him. Yeah. And then you decided that you'd just drop him in the middle of nowhere in sub-freezing temperatures. Yeah. You know, it just drives me insane when people come out with these ridiculous, ridiculous excuses. So in the middle of nowhere, on a sub-zero night, he just wants to get out. And apparently on top of this, Darryl argued that, you know, there was no law preventing them from releasing someone in the middle of nowhere. And according to the officers, Darryl said, look, boys, drop me off anywhere. Just don't take me in and charge me. Yeah, okay. Drop me anywhere where I might die and freeze to death, or take me to a police station where I'll spend a night and then go home. Drop me off in sub-zero temperatures where I might die. Take me to jail where I might live. Come on. But this is what the story is saying. Now, Darryl is, of course, completely adamant this was not the case. He said he'd fiercely resisted being removed from the police car. He threatened to report them. Now, at court, the officers did ultimately admit to leaving Darryl in sub-zero temperatures. They claimed that they'd made an error of judgment, and they asked the jury, not to convict them. I wish to rewind time so that I can be on the jury, because the jury impact and effect is really important when there is a strong character, and I would be that strong character. Life. I don't think they'd probably be able to have life, but I'd say life, and hopefully we'd get to a point of agreement as far as the jury were concerned. Now, unbelievably, in spite of them admitting that they did indeed leave this man to basically freeze to death, they were convicted of unlawful confinement. You have no idea how minimal this is, guys. Unlawful confinement. Now, also worth noting, it was an all-white jury, so may have been some bias there. And they were able to avoid every single one of the assault convictions. Now, they did actually get sacked from the police force, and they did actually receive a custodial sentence, but only 8 months. Now, the maximum sentence they could have been given for what they did was 10 years. It was piffly compared to what they should have got. And again, we're talking about a man who was left outside to freeze to death by two officers of the law who were meant to protect people. So the reason the sentence should be stern and strong and should represent a reality of what these individuals did is because if the people who are paid to protect you are basically threatening to kill you, they deserve a far, far stronger sentence than a person in the general public. Because in the general public, you have not taken an oath to serve and protect. They should have got 10 years. Now, the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, they said this charge is absolutely inadequate and that each of those officers should without a doubt have faced an attempted murder charge. And I absolutely agree with them. It is attempted murder. Now, there was actually a subsequent inquest by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Royal Canadian Mounted Police are lauded. They really are. They are considered the literal pinnacle. When the Mounties are called in, people often do breathe a sigh of relief because they are seen as fantastic at what they do. So they do this inquest, and it's called Project Ferric, and it's looking at the deaths of Rodney and Lawrence. So they also start to investigate other suspicious freezing deaths. This includes a 53-year-old First National, Lloyd Dustyhorn. So on the 19th of January 2000, Lloyd was found frozen to death outside the Saskatoon apartment building. Now, the day before, police had actually arrested him for public intoxication, and he ended up spending 18 hours in police custody. During that period of time in police custody, he was actually suffering from hallucinations. Clearly, if you're dealing with somebody, even if they're heavily under the influence of alcohol and intoxicated, and that's causing them to hallucinate, medical attention should occur. If they aren't intoxicated, then medical attention should occur because somebody could be having a psychotic break. This is a really important attention issue. You don't spend 18 hours in police custody hallucinating without being attended by a medic. That's just appropriate safeguarding. But after that 18 hours, he's just released and is found frozen to death. Literally 3 hours, in fact, after his release. Now, allegedly, he was dropped off by the police outside his apartment. It was minus 35 degrees. He was wearing a shirt, pants, and shoes. So let's imagine for a minute that he was actually dropped off outside his apartment, like taken to his place of residence. If he is dealing with hallucinations, he could be highly suspicious. He could be highly paranoid. He might not even recognize where his apartment is. He may not be able to compute what he needs to do to get in. To not get somebody who's been hallucinating safely into their place of residence is an absolute departure from safeguarding. It's unbelievable. And for 3 hours, that's all it took between him being alive and being dead. And that also gives you an indication of just how dire it is when you're in that kind of cold environment. It's horrific. Anybody who's watched any documentaries on people who've got hypothermia and when it sets in, the impact it has mentally, but also obviously the impact that it has physically, it's an agonizing, horrific, terrifying death. And a minute in such circumstances feels absolutely incredibly long. Imagine 3 hours slowly freezing to death. maybe hallucinating at the same time because you're having a psychotic break, then furthered by the actual hypothermia and what that does to your brain. Now, meanwhile, and completely understandably, the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations set up a police harassment hotline because so many people are being harassed. And the whole premise of this is that they want to involve the local community. They want the community to realise that they can make complaints against the police so they can build a case. They were inundated, not necessarily by people complaining, because the phone lines were jammed with racist callers. I kid you not. So this line that's encouraging people from the local community to share the issues that they have had with police brutality or racism, it is problematic because so many racists decide to get in contact to let them know how happy they are that this helpline exists. This is an example of one of the calls that came. They said, if you people act like human beings instead of a bunch of animals, maybe everybody would get along better. Yeah, you sound like such a well-adjusted human. Let's just go through that again. Compassionate human being that you are. If you people act like human beings instead of a bunch of animals, maybe everybody would get along better. Says the person hogging the line that's there for people to be able to complain about the racism they experience. Oh, how ironic. I mean, that person is probably a vicar or a priest, aren't they? The empathy and compassion running through their veins is clear through their words. What kind of people do that? Honestly, I ask this, I digress a little bit, guys, but what kind of person sees a helpline that's offering support for people who may have experienced and endured racism and actually feels, I'm gonna pick it up and I'm gonna call them and I'm gonna call them animals and I'm gonna tell them that if they weren't such horrible human beings, the world would be a better place. What kind of a human, firstly, has that much time? Firstly, has that much time in their pathetic lives? And secondly, feels the need to express the malevolence within them to other individuals who may actually be dealing with some really challenging experiences? What weirdos? That's the only word that I can use. You won't find that in any kind of assessment psychologically. Weirdo, category of person who rings helplines and says inappropriate things. I don't write that diagnostic stuff. If I did, there'd be a few categories like that. We'd have not right in there, wouldn't we? And wrong-un. All of these would be in there. Now, ultimately, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police inquest proves inconclusive. I kid you not. Sorry, what's the report? Well, we've done a very thorough investigation. Oh, good, good. Because all these First Nations men, they keep ending up frozen in light outerwear in areas they shouldn't even be. So we're really happy that you are going to be able to conclude the information that we can receive to make our world a better place and make it safer for such First Nations men. What is the result of your extensive study and report and inquest into this situation?
Inconclusive.
Pardon?
Inconclusive.
You've not concluded anything.
We've concluded nothing. We've concluded that it's completely inconclusive. There you go. And that's why I'm a mounted police officer.
Honestly, apparently they weren't able to determine how the freezing deaths had occurred.
Is it? Is it very difficult to determine how the freezing deaths has occurred?
Really? Is it? Because I don't know much about how you police, but I think that guys turning up without the right kind of coats, jackets, shoes, in the middle of nowhere, suggests that they've been taken there. Throwing it out there. Just having a bit of a guess here. And I've not even done the inquest.
Now, ultimately, that Royal Canadian Mounted Police inquest, when I tell you proved inconclusive, don't get angry, because I would instantly be like, what do you mean it's inconclusive? How can you possibly be reporting on something that's inconclusive when men are turning up freezing to death? What I'm talking about with the inconclusive is that they couldn't actually determine how the freezing deaths had occurred, apparently. However, what they did manage to expose was this incredibly lethal practice that was carried out by Saskatoon police. And this practice had been going on for decades. known as Starlight Tours. Now, Starlight Tours sounds endearing, romantic even. Who wouldn't want to go on a Starlight Tour? Well, you wouldn't. You certainly wouldn't want to go on one with Saskatoon Police. Because what this practice actually was an officer or officers would drop off intoxicated people on the edges of town so that they could apparently sober up by walking back. I mean, in sub-zero freezing temperatures, whilst people are already intoxicated, which means that hypothermia is far more likely. But apparently this is just to get them to sober up, right? But the reality is that allegations have been made and made correctly that this wasn't about getting people to sober up. There was a far, far more sinister practice. This was about racism. This was about not valuing certain individuals' lives. So Aboriginals have claimed that since the mid-1970s, members of their communities have been taken into custody, often for very minor infractions, sometimes for no reason at all. And then officers had taken them on one of these Starlight Tours. So driven them to the outskirts of town, left them in freezing conditions. And as early as 1976, the police department had actually had to discipline an officer for abandoning a woman, an Indigenous woman, outside of the city. So they can see, tracking back, this has been going on for decades. The Project Ferwick inquiry also rightly re-examines Neil Stonechild's death. So they look at the death 10 years earlier. And the reason for this is it just has such striking similarities to what they're finding out. Now, ultimately, and as far as I'm concerned, bizarrely, no charges were brought against the officers in relation to the 1990 freezing deaths or Neil's. But the inquiry did recommend that an independent inquiry should be carried out into Neil's death. It's shocking to me how you can hear and feel the way that all of these systems play against victims. So what we should be doing is seeking truth and finding out what happened and bringing to justice those responsible. But what seems to occur is all of this bureaucracy and ways of saying we're finding things out and we're doing our job without really doing their job at all. Personally, that's how I feel. Now, Justice David Wright, he essentially heads a subsequent public inquiry. This commenced in February 2003. So that's more than 12 years after Neil's death. Now, Neil's mother, Stella Bignall, she testified at the inquiry and she actually described the last time that she had spoken with her son. Bear in mind that he was serving the 6-month open custody sentence at a group home at the time. Now, she was actually really unhappy with him when she spoke to him because he was going to a house party. And obviously she was concerned about anything that could have implications for his future and that could affect what he was doing at that particular open custody sentence. He's clearly concerned for her son. But he just reassured her, he'd hugged her, he said it's going to be fine. And he just let her know that she didn't have to worry about him. Also, he told her, I can't call you because I don't have a phone there. The last thing that happened between them is he gave her a kiss and then he left. And that's the last time that she saw him alive. Every mother or father listening to this, or caregiver, you will all appreciate that feeling of fear. Because it happens to people. You have a kiss goodbye with your child, you say, I love you, and then you never see them again. It's the biggest fear that we have. But for his mother, this happened. You know, they had that little row because she was worried about the fact that he might do something that could affect his future. He reassures her, he leaves, they have that kiss, and that's it. She never sees him again alive. Now, Neil's friend, Jason Roy, very brave young man. He'd actually been with Neil on the night out when he died, and he went and testified at the inquiry. Now, Jason was literally 16 at the time, a really young man. And bear in mind what he was doing at that inquiry. He was calling out the authorities, and that's a dangerous place to be, a dangerous position to be. Remember, when you take on an institution and an establishment, there are consequences and possibilities and potentials that you may fear happening for good reason. The idea that people don't disappear, the idea that people don't end up being horribly persecuted, the idea that bad things don't happen to individuals that they care for after such things happening is something that's borne out in reality. People have had horrific and dire consequences for speaking their truth. So doing this, to an institution and an establishment that's already proved to be incredibly racist must have been terrifying. He was fearful of those repercussions from the police, but he was more fearful of not doing right by his friend. It was his loyalty and his belief in justice that meant he stood there. He wanted to tell the inquiry the truth of what happened that night because he was there. He saw it. Already, I think we all agree that somebody like Jason is a far better human being than any of the officers that we've been talking about so far. So he gives the inquiry this timeline and he states that he and Neil had been at the house party and they'd left just before midnight. Now, later that night, so in the early hours of the 25th of November 1990, police had been called to Confederation Park. This is where Neil and Jason were allegedly drunk and causing a disturbance. So the last time that Jason actually sees his friend, he's in the back of a police cruiser, and he claimed that Neil's face was just gushing with blood. Now, Jason said he was actually questioned by the two officers who had Neil in custody. That was Constables Larry Hartwig and Bradley Senger. And he'd actually given them a false name, Tracy Lee Horse. Now, according to Jason, when all this was going on, Neil was literally screaming and shouting to him. And his last words were, "Jay, help me. They're going to kill me." So Neil has this sense of real foreboding. He's believing that something terrible is going to befall him. And my God, he's right. Now, Jason's version of events were actually supported by Neil's injuries. So do you remember what we were saying about when he was in the open casket, the fact that there were those two marks on his nose? It's likely made by the handcuffs. So on the balance of probabilities, that had happened in police custody. And then furthermore, on the night of Neil's death, also Constable Senger had actually performed a search on the police computer for Tracy Horse and Tracy Lee Horse. That was a false name that was given by Jason. But minutes later, that same officer had performed a search for Neil Stonechild. So they clearly interacted with Neil on the night that he died. So Jason tells the inquiry that he'd actually given a statement to the police at the time of Neil's death and had told them that Neil had been in the back of the patrol car. But this statement had ultimately been excluded from the investigator Jarvis's report. So Jarvis claimed that the investigator from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had planted suggestions in Jason's mind. He denied that Stonechild had ever even been in the back of the police car. I mean, just think about this, guys. So we now know that Jason specifically saw Neil with the officers. He saw blood on his face, where clearly there'd been an altercation with the officers, probably with the handcuffs hitting his face. He'd been in a scenario where he's basically screaming for his life. Then he turns up dead, and apparently the police have got no record of him whatsoever. But in the database, they've searched both his friend's name that was obviously fake and Neil's name. And yet they're still standing by the story that Stonechild had literally never been in the back of a police car. Now, Jarvis is ultimately asked to do a polygraph test, a lie detector, but apparently refuses and becomes angry. That isn't suspicious. One wouldn't imagine for one minute that somebody who would refuse to do a lie detector test would potentially be trying to, I don't know, hide something. Now, during the course of the inquiry, Saskatoon police finally acknowledged its investigation into Neil's death had been substandard and inadequate. And that is the biggest understatement I have made for some time on this channel. So they finally apologised to Neil's family, which is just appalling. What is an apology? Neil's dead. Now, the subsequent finding of the public inquiry, which was released in October 2004, it made it clear just how substandard that initial report had been. Bear in mind, the morality department. Bear in mind, what could he possibly have died of? He had just frozen to death in the snow. Remember what I said right at the beginning of this? It's why the sarcasm started very, 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 very early on. It's because the cover-up of this death is just exponentially disgusting. It's because they made out there was no reason for why Neil died, aside from his own stupidity. The inquiry concluded this. The police investigation had been superficial at best, and was concluded prematurely. Why? Because it had been purposely botched because investigators either knew or suspected fellow officers were involved. Now, I'm going to tell you just how badly this was botched, how disgraceful this scenario plays out. Investigators did not even look at photos of the field where Neil's body was found, or of Neil's clothing, or of the autopsy, didn't even view Neil's body at the morgue. And remember how they said that they couldn't really figure out how he died, apart from he'd frozen to death, inebriated, i.e. you're not a victim, you caused this yourself, sweetheart, that kind of line. Well, that's bull, because the autopsy had actually very well established that the reason that had contributed to Neil's death was because he'd been very badly beaten. In fact, his death had been no accident whatsoever. The report concluded that Neil had, on balance of probabilities, been driven out by Hartwig and Senger to the outskirts of the city and left alone in temperatures of minus 28 degrees C. He was basically slowly executed by those officers. It's the only way you can look at this. Now, the inquiry made four recommendations to the Saskatchewan province and four to police. What were those recommendations? Sack all your officers. Sack all your officers. Let's start again. We have some endemic issues in your system. Probably not that severe, I'm going to be honest. So the recommendations included that officers had to complete an in-depth race relations training, and this had to have a focus on Indigenous culture, history, social structures, so that officers could understand the rich history and also start to form a respect for the Indigenous culture and population, which is something that I think is really imperative when you are looking at individuals whose history, which is rich and full, has almost been sidelined or ignored, to some degree eradicated at times. So that particular recommendation is clearly going to hopefully connect people more who might not understand a particular culture and population and bring their culture and understanding of that culture into the light, so to speak. Now, in response to the inquiries firing regarding Hartwig and Senger, bear in mind, these guys said he was never in my car. In fact, those guys who searched for them on the database, who were seen with him in the car, and they still deny that they had anything to do with him. They continue to claim to this day that it's just all BS, it's made up. Now, they were both suspended from their jobs, rightfully so, and then they were later fired. This is in November 2004. However, with support from Saskatoon Police, can we rename that, please, as corrupt? Corrupt Police, let's do that. They actually were able to appeal the decision to fire them, and they even tried to quash some of the inquiry's finding. Now, Saskatoon Police Association paid around $400,000 of their legal bills. Yeah. Trying to defend what I personally believe are two killers. Now, both of those appeals actually failed because there was a wealth of evidence that says that they're making it up and they don't deserve to have any opportunity to be involved in the forces or to receive any financial support from them ongoing. But the very fact that they appealed so heavily shows that they don't have any guilt. They don't think they've done anything wrong. They know the truth. But the truth is, for them, it doesn't matter. Because I don't think that that child had any meaning to them whatsoever. They were just doing what other officers did. There was a permission base in the force. They were following that permission base. No big deal, right? That's horrendous. But fortunately, like I said, they both failed in their attempts to appeal. Now, despite the conclusions that were reached in that inquiry that are clearly noting and pointing the finger of blame at Hartwig and Senger, neither of them face any criminal prosecution for their actions. In fact, incredibly, and I said this is why it's really upsetting covering this case, not one single officer has ever been prosecuted for causing the deaths of any of the Saskatoon freezing deaths. That's horrendous. Not one person. These individuals were just left to die. They were premeditated, as far as I'm concerned, deaths. The officers who went on those starlight tours knew what they were doing. They removed coats. They removed shoes. They made it so those individuals had no chance on the whole of surviving. Now, The reality is, what they've tried to do is to make out that these are isolated incidents in Canadian history, but it's absolute rubbish. A study by the University of Winnipeg established that at least 76 people had been subjected to starlight tours by the Winnipeg police. Meanwhile, former Saskatoon police officers Larry Hartwig and Bradley Sanger, they continued to maintain their innocence, and they say, "I had no contact with Neil. Neil Stonechild was nothing to do with us. We had no connection with him. We searched on the database. We were seen with him bleeding in the car. But at the end of the day, we were not anything to do with it." Absolute PS. And how horrific for his family that these two individuals still walk the streets, still free, still feeling that they have a right to that freedom that was denied to Neil Stonechild. Now, Saskatoon police, they didn't want to be tarnished by the legacy of those freezing deaths. So one of the things that they did, which again to me just blows my mind, because this is real, this is history, this is investigations, there are inquiries. Therefore, understandably, you'll find things like Wikipedia pages. Now, Wikipedia pages are not things that we always control. Some people can choose to create a Wikipedia page, but there are lots of editors who can change things. Sometimes it's quite funny. For example, my sister's ex-head teacher wasn't a very nice woman. She was given an MBE by the Queen. A lot of people who aren't very nice get these kind of accolades. And this particular individual was not very well liked. And one day somebody edited at the end of this big thing that was saying about how great she was as a head teacher and all these things she'd apparently done for the local community. And at the bottom it said that she was a recovering crackhead. So somebody had gone in and done that. It didn't stay there long. I'm just saying, it amused a lot of the teachers who used to work under her, stroke be bullied by her. Sorry, did I say that? Anyway, Wikipedia pages are one of those things that you might put up with good intention, but then other people can change it. So you better be ready to sometimes read things about yourself or see things about others that might not be entirely true or that person doesn't have the control over. But the Starlight Tours were on Wikipedia. For good reason. There had been investigations and inquiries, and the consequence was that this was out there. But then suddenly, a whole entry from Wikipedia about Starlight Tours is just removed. And when they actually look into it, it's established that the edit had originated from an IP address located in the Saskatoon Police Department. What? In the Saskatoon Police Department? Why would the Saskatoon Police Department want to remove a reality-based entry about Starlight Tours? I have no idea, because they're all very, very honest. No one in the Saskatoon Police Department would ever lie. Did somebody remove it from the department? We don't believe so. They would never lie. It's literally your IP address. Hackers are very clever these days. They may have got into the police department and done that. I mean, obviously, people wanted it removed because they don't want any association with reality. Now, the Saskatoon police ultimately had to admit that it was actually a member of their department and personnel who had done it, but they couldn't identify who it was. Oh, how unfortunate for them. How unfortunate that they couldn't identify who it was who had removed the entry. It's not like in the police department you'd have to, I don't know, sign into a computer, go through some security checks, actually go to the page that you're going to alter, have a history like we all do in our computers so that, you know, inappropriate stuff could be identified. But apparently not. Apparently not. Apparently in Saskatoon Police Department, that isn't how it works. Works like that everywhere else. Everywhere else. But not in the police department. A little bit worried when you're considering what they're there to do. Now, according to a 2016 census, 1.67 million people in Canada identify themselves as an Aboriginal person, and they are actually the fastest growing population in Canada. And their heritage, when you look at it, it's been really interesting reading about this and getting to know it. That heritage dates back thousands of years, and yet in spite of that, they essentially remain second-class citizens. Now, the social and economic conditions and experience of Aboriginals in Canada has impacted on the education, the health, and the employment of this population. And these factors have basically seen Aboriginal communities flooded with drugs, flooded with crime. And this means, of course, that it brings them into conflict with the justice system. Now, Aboriginal involvement in crime is proportionally higher than that of non-natives in Canada. So in Saskatchewan, Indigenous people comprise 5% of the total population, but over half of the prison population. But this is because of all those dire social and economic issues that I've just covered. Because there are so many problems that have been pressed upon them and that population, the reaction is lower advantages, lower economic well-being, and higher crime rates, and also higher self-medication when it comes to things like drug dependency, and therefore crime is also higher. But as half of the prison population are from that community, it tells us something really important about the social requirements of meeting needs differently. Because clearly there is something very wrong when the Indigenous population is faring so badly. Now, for some people, you could say arguably, well, maybe they need to try harder, do better. At the end of the day, they don't have to commit crime. And I appreciate the sentiments of people who feel that way. But if statistically you're looking at such high percentages, you have to also say, well, why? And part of that is because of oppression. And part of that is because of the actual racism, because they're not given opportunities that they deserve. And even if, let's just put it on the table, people are out there hard line going, no, Emma, at the end of the day, they didn't need to commit crime. They've got themselves into this situation. They need to acknowledge and accept it and take responsibility for it. Well, even if you take that hard line, which I don't, the reality is that none of that detracts whatsoever from the discrimination by the police and by the courts that still exists today. They don't get the same fair trial that other people do from white communities. It doesn't happen. The fact that to date, not one person has been actually held responsible for Neil Stonechild's death is reprehensible. In fact, not one person has ever been held responsible for any of the other Saskatoon freezing deaths arising from the infamous Starlight Tours. And that's a blight on Canada. It's a blight on the Saskatoon police. It's a blight on the population who allows this systemic abuse to exist and be perpetuated. And even if you take the really hard line approach that I was saying before, where you say to yourself, well, they deserve to be in prison, they've committed crime, or they've got dependency issues because they're making those choices, and you show no sympathy and empathy for the oppression and systemic oppression that we can see evidenced in what I've talked about today, and that is very well documented, what we cannot do is turn away from the reality that these individuals who are meant to protect us, the police and law enforcement, actively chose not only to put these individuals at risk, but they took the bias and belief system that was reprehensible, oppressive, and racist, and gave license to actions that ended these men's lives. That is such a detraction, such an abandonment of the duties of those individuals that the callousness is hard to describe. Neil and all those other men, they should be alive today, and they would be alive today if those Starlight Tours had not been created, permission-based, and consistently carried out. There is so much evidence that the police do not see the Indigenous populations on a level as they do the white population. And it's a very difficult thing as a white person to feel and hear and know that, but it's evidenced in the research and the inquiries that have been carried out. To not be able to give any justice to this case, to not be able to say, and this officer went down for this many years, and that officer was convicted of A, B, or C, it's just wrong.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.